You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and specifically today with the Africa Security Initiative. We team up here with our friends in global economy and development who have an Africa growth initiative and work and hold events occasionally on subjects of concern to the great continent of Africa. And my partner in such activities here at Brookings is often, and in the case of today as well, Vonda Felbab-Brown, just to my left, who's recently back from several weeks of field research, actually in a number of different countries, most recently Southeast Asia, but earlier in the winter, Nigeria. And similarly, my new friends, Alexandra LaMarche and Mark Yarnell from Refugees International, also did field work in Nigeria earlier this year and have written a new report, Political Pressure to Return, putting Northeast Nigeria's displaced citizens at risk, in which they are concerned about the treatment of internally displaced and refugee populations in this area that's now been in the news for a long time, as you're all well aware, I'm sure, in this room. This is the area in Nigeria where Boko Haram has been a problem. It's getting to be a long-standing and sad story. There are occasional glimmers of hopefulness, as, for example, with the release of the most recently kidnapped group of schoolgirls who were released in recent weeks. And there's a little bit of hopefulness in the writings of our panelists today, I've detected. But certainly they're not here to celebrate any major milestones or accomplishments just yet. I think that's a fair overall theme to offer to you, and they can correct me if they don't like my one-sentence summary. There's a lot of work left to do, and as noted, the IDPs and other populations in northeastern Nigeria are still very much at risk, and the area is still very much unsettled. Even with today's news, I think in the Wall Street Journal, that there are ongoing negotiations, it would appear, between the Nigerian government and the Islamic State of West Africa province. That's only a splinter out of Boko Haram, and who knows where those negotiations will go in any event. So we've got a long ways to go. In Africa's most populous country, a quarter of the entire population of the continent, therefore hugely important, and also a struggling but real democracy that continues to try to find its way forward. So a country of enormous significance, one of the five or six most populous on Earth, again, far and away the most populous on the continent, and we're here today to discuss specifically Northeast Nigeria, but in the context of the status of things overall in the country, the kinds of political challenges, economic and development challenges the country faces. So we'll begin by my turning the floor now to Vonda, who is going to frame, I think, a larger picture of the region and maybe even in the context of the whole country's current challenges. And then we'll go on to our friends from Refugees International with their report and their discussion. We'll mix it up a little bit here before we go to you for your thoughts and questions in about 45 minutes. So without further ado, Vonda, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to see interest in Nigeria, and thank you for joining us on the panel and holding this event. Nigeria often these days does not get enough exposure and discussion in Washington. And that's a partially reflection that the intensity of the fighting, the intensity of the Boko Haram seems and is lesser than it was at its peak when Boko Haram would be killing 11,000 people a year. Nonetheless, the kidnapping of February of Dapchi of 110 schoolgirls shook up many, including many in Nigeria, where the government has for a long time been saying since 2015 that Boko Haram had been technically defeated. And so people ask, well, if Boko Haram is technically defeated, how come this attack happened again? And of course, the reality is that although Boko Haram is far from anywhere at the level of its peak operational capacity, it no longer has the capacity to take on and displace and push out entire battalions of the Nigerian military, as was happening with regular basis throughout up till 2015. The Nigerian military has been stuck in, I don't want to say a stalemate, but in the typical really difficult phase of counterinsurgency, namely the holding operation. The Nigerian military is deployed throughout Nigeria's 32 states. There are many other in 32 out of 36 states, there are very many other security issues that the military is responding. And that's partially a function of the design where states do not have their own policing forces. All police forces are at the federal level deployed by Abuja and deployed by Abuja according to specific quota. The consequence of which, however, is that it should be the military because the often police forces are not available to be doing holding operations. And that's a major problem. So we have seen areas where the military has nominally cleared Boko Haram, but it's pushed out Boko Haram, with Boko Haram coming back. Travel along major roads in the northeast is still highly restricted and often quite risky. Certainly on secondary roads, the chance of Boko Haram attacks is substantial, but even on major roads, the military often does not allow individual travel. Boko Haram is... sorry, it's the mic is not working?
No, your microphones are actually working.
Okay, thank you.
We're not hearing you very well.
Okay, thanks for letting us know. Did the mic come on? Is the mic on now?
Let me check to see if the system is on at all. So can people hear me?
The system is on.
Okay.
Okay, is the mic better now that it's closer up? Okay, so apologies that you haven't heard that. My core point was that although Boko Haram is nowhere at the level of operational capacity it had up to 2015, it still remains a potent force that's still causing a lot of insecurity. The government, the Nigerian military, struggles massively in holding territory. And often Boko Haram has returned into territories from which it's been cleared. That does not necessarily mean that it retakes and holds those territories, but it conducts a variety of offensive operations. And there is certainly widespread fears. Nominally, local government administrations have returned to all areas of Borno State and throughout Northeast. In practice, they're often very restricted in their operational capacity, and they fear Boko Haram attacks. So the situation in many ways is stuck in a stalemate. The issue of negotiations is not new. It's been many times. It's been brought up many times. Boko Haram declared allegiance to the Islamic State and renamed itself the Islamic State in West Africa, from which a branch of Islamic State has then split off that calls itself the true Islamic State. I'll speak about them in a minute. They're a fascinating contrast to the Boko Haram dominant aspect of the Islamic State. But before I get to that, I also want to emphasize that the Nigerian military and the anti-Boko Haram militias, the so-called Civilian Joint Task Force, continue to be huge sources of insecurity themselves. Although the level of abuses, extrajudicial killing, massacres of entire communities, often involving hundreds of people slaughtered by the Nigerian military or allegedly slaughtered by the Nigerian military at one time in one day, are no longer present with that same extent. A lot of the liberation operations still involve arresting or killing males in a village without really ascertaining in any robust way whether they are Boko Haram, and anyway, even if they were, they should not be simply killed, and dragging of women and children en masse into detention centers. So the Nigerian, there are other counterinsurgency operations that continue to be in place, such as prohibiting the growth of tall crops that significantly compounds the famine that the Nigerian government has refused to call famine, but the severe food crisis that's plagued northeast Nigeria in 2016-2017 and is hardly over. The Nigerian military operations continue to involve collecting all knives and tools from a village, which means that villagers cannot go about slaughtering livestock, slaughtering chicken, providing food for themselves. And the Nigerian military has become deeply involved and controls all kinds of regular economic activity, with the justification that Boko Haram taxes growing crops, taxes fishing, taxes transport. So the Nigerian military tries to limit and prohibit the activity, but also taxes it illegally itself. And so there is now deep permeation of the Nigerian military police and the CJTF, the militias, into local economic environment. My last comment then on the Islamic State, the split of branch of the Islamic State. And in the Q&A, we can talk about negotiations, history of negotiations, when they work, when they haven't, why. Is that out of the three actors, the military, the state, the Boko Haram version of the Islamic State, and the split of branch, it's the split of branch that's actually by far the most discriminating actor. They have scrupulously tried to avoid civilian casualties. They do not attack mosques. And more than just about many an actor, and certainly in contrast to Boko Haram, they provide services. So, for example, in some villages in the alluvial plains of the northeast, they have taken women, pregnant women, to a hospital, something no one has ever done. They are clearly very much differentiating themselves from Boko Haram, and they are seeking to really develop a state-like agenda and a state-like presence that often outclasses the presence of the Nigerian state. And so in this context, the humanitarian response, and I would say not just the humanitarian response, but really building up an accountable present state is crucial for countering not just the immediate threat of Boko Haram, but the more insidious long-term threat of militant groups developing far greater legitimacy than the state.
Fantastic, Vonda. Thank you. I've got a couple of follow-up questions, but I'll hold them for now and come back to those after we hear from Alexandra and Mark. I want to add a quick additional word on Alexandra. She's only recently arrived in the United States from Canada, so I feel guilty we've given her such a bad spring so far. Certainly anybody who grew up in Canada deserves a better March than Washington has delivered this year, but she's worked for the Canadian government on issues concerning security in Africa and is both Francophone and Anglophone, so has worked on a number of different countries, French-speaking and English-speaking Africa, and we're just delighted to have her and Mark here today, so the floor is yours, my friend.
Thank you very much. So as Vonda said, obviously the crisis is in its ninth year and shows no signs of truly waning. While Boko Haram has been weakened, it is far from over. Security fluctuates, and areas that were deemed to be secure in the worst-affected states of Yobe, Adamawa, and Borno have now re-spiraled down into violence. And this is just, Adamawa saw large-scale returns last year and this year because of safety, and it's found itself again in a cycle of violence and targeted by attacks. Though the Nigerian military has been successful in recapturing larger towns from Boko Haram, much of the rural areas have not been reclaimed or are falling under insurgent control. Northeastern Nigeria still faces food shortages and poor service delivery. Security threats, including combat operations and bombings, continue to cause civilian casualties and displacement. As such, the humanitarian consequences are staggering. There are 1.6 million people who are still displaced in the Northeast. 7.7 million are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. And there are estimates that there are 930,000 people who are in hard-to-reach areas by the humanitarian community, a number which has been pretty contested by the Nigerian authorities. So in Borno State, obviously the epicenter of the crisis and home of Boko Haram, the Borno State hosts the majority of the displaced populations, the majority of which are found in its capital city of Maiduguri. At its height, the numbers were near a million. They're now closer to between 200 and about 300,000 people. As the government forces have been able to recapture land, many people have been leaving Maiduguri to go back to where they came from, often before it's been safe to do so, just because conditions in IDP camps have been terrible, or if not just poor. And this is a huge concern. So while these returns are voluntary, we support voluntary returns, the fact that they've been sort of premature is a source of concern for the safety and well-being of these people. The humanitarian response itself suffers from systemic weakness. The United Nations and other international aid organizations have failed to create robust mechanisms to respond to protection issues, which are extremely widespread throughout the region. And without effective civilian military coordination, the humanitarian community remains divided on the question of appropriate engagement with the Nigerian military when it comes to relief efforts. For its part, the Nigerian government has been deeply disorganized. Many different agencies claim to be sort of the apex coordinating body and that they're in charge of the response. There's a huge lack of communication between these different government agencies and a lack of coordination and cooperation between them, too, with many of them vying for funds. For the displaced people themselves, daily existence obviously remains extremely difficult. People are heavily reliant on aid, which is even in itself not always great. Access to livelihoods is extremely limited, and food rations rarely last between monthly food distributions. As we all know, these displacement camps and settlements have been the scene of numerous suicide or so-called suicide attacks or armed attacks by Boko Haram. And as such, the government forces, along with the CJTF, the Civilian Joint Task Force, which is a paramilitary group that often operates sort of parallel to the Nigerian military, has created a pass system to protect these camps. However, this pass system, in which people apply to have permission to leave the camps, has become riddled with discrimination and sexual exploitation. So while we understand the very real imperatives and juggling between these two, or balancing between the two imperatives of wanting to protect people's lives and protect their rights and freedoms of freedom of movement, this system has become fraught. And obviously, we're very concerned about the implications of permitting people to go in and out. There are, not to say that there are not numerous other challenges in providing aid on the basis of humanitarian principles within a context where the military is often the first responder and oversees virtually every aspect of a response. In December, the governor of Borno, Governor Shettima, announced that he intended to have people leave Maiduguri and return to their areas of origin. Many of these areas were not yet safe or conducive for these large-scale returns. These returns have not yet happened. The deadline keeps being pushed back. However, there is a real sense of political urgency with an upcoming election. So that's something that we are watching very closely and what drove us to get to, or what pushed us to go to Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria. The most publicized of these plans was to go to Bama. So Bama used to be about 250,000 people. It was a Boko Haram stronghold from 2013 to 2015. And until the Nigerian forces were able to push them out. But because of that military victory, Bama holds a lot of political clout. And given the upcoming election, to have people return would be an extraordinary sort of photo opportunity to display that success. This is still a very fraught plan. It's a one-size-fits-all that 250,000 people will somehow want to return before the end of the year seems impossible. Many people have created new lives elsewhere in Nigeria or are too scared to return given the trauma that they faced. And then the governor earlier this month made a follow-up announcement that he intended to close all displacement camps within the state of Borno before the end of May. So that's just a few months away. Effectively forcing these people to return and cutting them off from the aid that they do receive right now in these centers. These announcements are obviously extremely alarming. Security is precarious throughout the Northeast, especially in Borno, and military campaigns are still ongoing, still cause civilian casualties, and still cause massive displacement. Bama itself is not conducive for returns. We traveled there in January to assess sort of the conditions on the ground, and while construction is ongoing, it is not safe for returns. And as Vonda said, you know, there's very limited road access. So you have 250,000 people that would live in a city that they'd be stuck in. It'd be hard to get them necessities. It would be hard for them even to travel to return. We ourselves had to travel by helicopter because the road is repeatedly the scene of armed attacks and explosions. It seems like a very short-sighted plan. So distress around these plans is compounded by that political urgency that we spoke of. The upcoming election is extremely worrying. I'm very alarmed by the fact that this is how people want to display success, would be to return people to a very dangerous setting.
Alexander, thank you. And an additional word of introduction on Mark, also Canadian by origin, came here, taught for Madeleine Albright at Georgetown as a teaching assistant, but has worked for Oxfam, the National Democratic Institute, something of particular interest to me. He worked for Merlin, a medical relief organization in my old Peace Corps country of Democratic Republic of Congo. So he's got a lot of experience already on various issues concerning many African states and has worked from a number of different vantage points, including now Refugees International. So, Mark, any further thoughts to compliment your colleagues, please?
Yeah, thanks so much. And can everyone hear me okay? As Alexander said, we traveled together to Northeast Nigeria earlier this year. I'm just going to touch on the top line recommendations we're making to try to help ameliorate the current challenges to the humanitarian response, and then engage in one particularly challenging issue, and then just we'll look forward to the discussion. Certainly, first and foremost, urging the Nigerian government to refrain from carrying out large-scale premature returns given the conditions that exist now, and to make a clear plan for how it would happen in the future. And to that end, we're calling on the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, which is responsible for coordinating the protection response for internally displaced people, to invest much more in analyzing and assessing and understanding the true intentions for return of displaced people, so that we know the people that are interested in going home in the immediate term, maybe those who want to return in the longer term, but also there are likely many displaced who may never want to return, and we want to make sure that those rights are upheld, and that for people who have lost their livelihoods and feel it's too insecure to go back to their home area, they have the option to integrate and reside in their current local area of displacement. And then finally, I mean, can be a tricky issue in a context of donor fatigue, but the funding last year made a difference despite the challenges in allowing the responses to scale up and prevent the potential for famine. And so maintaining robust funding through 2018 is essential. And fortunately, we had some good news out of Congress in terms of the omnibus resolution and the amount of humanitarian funding that was maintained. Just on one issue that my colleague Alexander brought up and happy to engage on more is compared to any context in sub-Saharan Africa where I've visited with Refugees International over the past 6 years, I've never encountered a military that so has such an impact in controlling key aspects of the humanitarian response. And that's an issue that humanitarian agencies are grappling with in terms of how to engage the military appropriately, but how to maintain a level of neutrality and independence to be able to respond based on need, not just based on directions from the military. To get access to sites of internal displacement run by the government, you need the military to approve that access. For us to take the helicopter trip to Bama required military authorization. Once you're in Bama, moving around requires military authorization. So that reality exists, but what we didn't see was clear guidelines of how civilian humanitarian organizations can engage the military in an appropriate way while maintaining the ability to operate under humanitarian principles of neutrality and impartiality. So that's something that there's a great deal of division exists amongst aid organizations, and something that we address in our report and hope can be rectified in terms of having some more coordination. So I'll leave it there, but look forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all. So what I want to do now is really pose two main questions to the panelists before we go to you. First, I want to sort of zoom out, and then I want to zoom back in. And when I say zoom out, I'd like to, for those of us who are not Northeast Nigeria specialists and who partly view this problem in broader global terms and who remember when Boko Haram was one of the big affiliates, when ISIS seemed on the move and on the march, and that was 3 or 4 years ago, I'd like to sort of understand where we are on the path towards progress, because, again, there are elements of what I heard from all of you that are at least somewhat hopeful or at least reflect the situation of today may not be as bad as it had been. And again, if you dispute that characterization, feel free in a second to correct me. But, Vonda, you said Boko Haram's not quite as powerful as it was 3 or 4 years ago. And Alexandra and Mark, you're talking about the opportunity now to go back home, and maybe it's just being seized upon too quickly, but there is an opportunity that wasn't even there previously. So in this sense, one does get a feel for a gradual movement in the right direction. So the question is, first of all, is that a correct way to look at the big picture? You know, in grand historic terms, is the overall trend line sort of in the right direction? But secondly, and I guess more importantly, more to the point, is that direction likely to continue, irrespective of the specific things you're talking about today? In other words, are the forces of history enough on government side that it's probably going to, you know, gradually get to where we all would like to see it? And the real question is how many people suffer along the way, which is important, but it's also largely a local humanitarian question. Or is the whole strategic problem still up for grabs, that Boko Haram could make a big comeback, that the region could deteriorate into more widespread violence again, and maybe even civil warfare? Is that risk still there? So I hope that was a clear enough question, but if you could, you know, how much progress have we made, and do you see that progress likely to continue, or is that what we're talking about today, that this progress is fragile, it's up for grabs, and it could still be reversed if a lot of what you three are proposing is not adopted by Nigeria and the broader international community? If I could start with you, Vanda.
Well, Mike, whether you are an optimist or pessimist in life depends on where you set your baselines. Yeah. If the baseline is 2011, 2012, we are clearly in a much better situation. You know, at the height of the insurgency effort, the presence of the Nigerian military and government was extremely limited. Boko Haram controlled very large areas. It was extraordinarily brutal, controlled Maiduguri, and we were seeing death rates at the level of 10, 11,000, 8,000 a year. Now, for about 2-3 years, we are seeing death rates at about 3,500 a year. That's not insignificant. You and I know Afghanistan very well. Those are quite common numbers in another country in Afghanistan. However, the progress that was accomplished from about 2015, 2016, in my view, has already got stuck. I don't necessarily envision that we would end up in a situation where we have a whole repeat of Boko Haram retaking large portions of state. What I fear very much is that we'll end up in a situation where we are in a protracted morass for very many years to come, while the split of branch of Islamic State is building up power and building up legitimacy in a way that Boko Haram fortunately failed to do. And I fear that the deeper issue that Nigeria as a country needs to struggle, not just the Northeast, the issue of a state that is present, that is accountable, that stops being a state that's neglectful and abusive and extraordinarily exclusionary, is not corrected. And in that case, we'll simply see the mutation of one form of militancy into another. There is a major bomb threat, or Thai bomb, right now in northeast Nigeria that we have not really explicitly mentioned, which is the militias, the CJTF. The CJTF self-assesses that it has 25 to 27,000 members. There's no verification by anyone what the actual numbers are. The CJTF is now stratified into three layers. One layer that the government, the smallest, has armed and pays. Another layer that the government has armed but doesn't pay, and the vast majority that doesn't get paid or has not been armed by the Nigerian military, by the government. They are very restless, very unhappy. There is a lot of frustrations. The second layer wants to be paid, just like the first layer, and the third layer wants to be armed and wants to be paid. I interviewed a number of the commanders and soldiers, and they were pretty... combatants, they were fighters, they were pretty explicit that, as one of the sector commanders put it to me, if we don't end up on a systematic government payroll, who's to say that we cannot start rising up against the state? He put it in more straightforward terms than I have just translated the statement. Essentially said, look, we can rise up as well. And they're a major factor in the elections. The CJTF is one of the gatekeepers to the IDP camps, and they are being used to generate votes in IDP camps. They are a principal source of who gets arrested. Often arrests of entire villages take place on the basis of some CJTF member saying, this is Boko Haram, this is not Boko Haram, this is Boko Haram, and people are dragged off to detention for months and years, still continually today, simply on the hearsay from CJTF. And there is already effort to politicize CJTF for the 2019 elections. Politicians in the Northeast are picking commanders, starting to deliver goods to them, to use them as a mechanism to get votes. One other caveat that I will, another context that I want to put in is, of course, that this is hardly the sole conflict happening in Nigeria. There are many sources of conflict throughout the country, one of which is the conflict between the farmers and herders, not just in the Northeast and not just in the Middle Belt, but also now very much seeping into the South and in complex ways interacting across the different conflicts that used to be quite isolated. And last year, that conflict perhaps caused more casualties than Boko Haram. I say perhaps, the numbers are quite tight. But so all of that paints a picture that's hardly just a steady march toward progress in Nigeria. In my view, the by far the most fundamental issue is to really bring far more accountability to government institutions than Nigeria has systematically experienced.
Yep, good. Thank you. Alexandra, I'm not sure if you want to address the question the way I phrased it or not, but feel free, I mean, to take whatever segment of it or slice of it you wish. I'm just curious for how you place today's moment in historical perspective for Nigeria, and if you see the path forward as, and again, the recommendations of your report, as largely sort of improving the humanitarian milieu along a path that hopefully will continue to be positive, or do you see that path itself as being up for grabs and uncertain, that things could be reversed, the situation could still dramatically deteriorate?
With regards to the humanitarian aspect of the situation, there's definitely been an improvement. I mean, our colleague was there in 2016, and there was barely any humanitarian architecture, so there is a vast improvement. But to add to what Vonda said, that Nigerian politics have been very exclusionary, and that the troubles in the Northeast predate this conflict. It has been systematically ignored, and that needs to be addressed. And with regards to the military aspect of it, I mean, yes, Boko Haram has been weakened, but the military is also very tired. I mean, they've been there for years and years and years without a switch up, without funds, without, you know, proper, you know, there's a huge discrepancy and terrible lines of communication between the field level to Maiduguri to Abuja. So it's very, very hard to sort of fully understand what the extent of success and or weaknesses are. And with regards to Boko Haram, even calling it Boko Haram at this point in time seems troublesome because it has separated. It is multiple factions. Barnawi has a very different method of operation than Shekau does, and that needs to be taken in consideration when figuring how to move forward. And I just feel, yes, there's an improvement on many sides of it, but some of these problems that have been addressed have been sort of replaced with new problems now.
Great, thank you. Mark, over to you for the same question.
Yeah, just to build on that, I mean, In the immediate term, I mean, we've seen in very recent history seen the government and the military in a position to recapture cities that have been controlled by Boko Haram and to begin serious efforts at rebuilding. And I think that's why it's quite discouraging that the progress that's being made in terms of stability and rebuilding could be disrupted by large-scale premature returns to areas that are not yet fully secure and reconstructed. So in the town of Bama, the second largest city in Borno State, there's neighborhoods beginning to be rebuilt. The government, the military has a small 5-kilometer radius of control, but it has that, which it didn't have as of a couple of years ago. But military officers with whom we spoke were very candid that it's still difficult for them to expand that perimeter of security more in the current context, and that if you bring in many, many more IDP returns, it makes it even more difficult for them to maintain security in the area. So just balancing those practical realities with this political imperative that to demonstrate success and stability that may actually disrupt that very stability.
So I thought I wanted to zoom back in. Let me do that, and then we'll go to the audience for their thoughts and questions. I wanted to ask each of you to maybe expand a little on some of the recommendations that you've got in your writings and in what you've already said today, and not to go through them comprehensively, but to build on maybe one or two each and let you choose what you want to talk about in more detail. For example, Vonda, I know you've been concerned about the basic counterinsurgency tactics of the Nigerian military and collective punishment as one of their tools of trying to gain information and also deter harboring of Boko Haram or other extremist groups. And obviously the title of your report speaks for itself, that you don't want to see premature forced returns. But above and beyond that, you may want to comment on some of the preconditions that need to be improved so that those returns could happen down the road. So anyway, open for discussion to the three of you, just to add a couple more points. And again, maybe we can start with Vonda and just work down the row again on, you know, one or two things that you would like to see the Nigerian government do specifically in the short term, as well as the international community.
I would say that a crucial element that is, if that could be resolved, would help across several dimensions, is improving holding capacity. A lot of the existing problems with mass arrests, prolonged detentions in awful conditions that easily become themselves sources of radicalization, where boys as young as 9, 10, 11 are kept with adult men in very small crowded cells with often problematic access to food, water, hygiene, and shoved across many centers, often stuck there for years before they are released. A lot of that today is a function of not being able to effectively hold territory. So what the Nigerian military does when these days it engages in liberating operation often is to move people out. They don't feel confident in being able to screen people in field. They often insist that the in-field screening does not allow for effective gathering of intelligence of whether people are Boko Haram or not. And so they try to move everyone out into detention and other conditions. That itself generates tremendous displacement and further complicates the issues of return, any kind of sustainability of communities. So if the United States, the international community, could help work with Nigeria to develop better holding capacity, we would get away from policies that alienate people, that are easily sources of radicalization, that are deeply inconsistent with human rights, often violate human rights in massive scale in an egregious manner, and that are counterproductive across an entire range of issues such as IDPs, such as returns of communities, such as rebuilding of communities. The one caveat, one addition that I want to bring in that we haven't really spoken about, and it's very important for the Nigerian context. Mark, you spoke about how Nigeria is different in the role of military in the humanitarian dimension. What strikes me about Nigeria in the context of war settings in Africa and beyond Africa is the tremendous level of hostility and rejection between those who were displaced toward those who remained under Boko Haram rule. So the sense that many people in the Northeast and beyond essentially differentiate between good victims and bad victims. The good victims are those who ended up in IDP camps, who ran away. The bad victims are people who stayed under Boko Haram rule, who were enslaved by Boko Haram. There is tremendous bad blood between those two set of actors, between those set of populations, that already complicates defectors programs, rehabilitation efforts, reintegration efforts, will complicate in a severe manner humanitarian efforts and rebuilding. And there is real need to focus on healing among communities, of getting away from the notion that just because you lived under Boko Haram rule, you have become, quote, bastardized. You have become brainwashed. This level of societal distrust and resentment toward each other is a major concerning issue that can really spiral out of control in very dramatic ways.
Thank you. Alexandra, same question to you, please.
Just to add a little bit, I mean, that stigma is... you can see it everywhere, and you don't necessarily see it when it's on the large scale. So we'll talk about the Chibok girls and the Dapchi girls, and it's not the same sort of stigma that's attached to these girls and women, whereas a woman who will go, you know, was abducted for 2 years and managed to flee, if she goes back to a camp, she's stigmatized for the rest of her life. Like, she is disadvantaged in terms of food distributions, and that severely hinders people's ability to reintegrate, and also just, I mean, the personal psychological trauma that these women endure is completely neglected, and that's something that we saw repeatedly. So just to add to that point.
Yeah.
But with regards to a recommendation, the lack of accountability and transparency of the Nigerian government is extremely worrying, and that's why in our report we do call for there to be a clear, public, comprehensive plan. The Nigerian government has been completely quiet about how it intends to shut these camps down and how it intends to remove or move all these people back to their areas of origin. So it's very, very hard to hold the government accountable to a specific standard or a timeline or you know, a phased relocation when it's not giving any public information on how it's going to be done. So that's what my number one recommendation would be.
Thank you. Mark.
Sure. And just first, for anyone standing in the back, there's a handful of seats in the front. You can join us up here. Anyways, and just to, I think what, yeah, as Alexander says, we want to see a clear plan for returns, and at the same time, within that plan, have very clear acknowledgement by the government that many people, if they have it, have their own voluntary interest, or are able to express to live by their own voluntary interest, will not return home and do not wish to return to their home area, and will remain in urban centers, and we know this from trends of displacement over throughout history and over the past many decades. Once the situation becomes protracted past a few years, that many people will never be able to return to their home area. And so the need to acknowledge that reality and orient programming as much as you can away from the kind of care and maintenance humanitarian response and more towards urban planning that facilitates integration and access to local services. Because, and the sooner that can happen, the better. And I know the bank has been engaged, and we just hope that the government can itself link up those kinds of policies for people who remain integrated in cities.
Just one more question to tie this together before we bring you in. I want to link everything on the Northeast Nigeria issue to the broader reality of Nigeria today in a nutshell really quickly, and invite anybody else to comment if they want to add a point. I mentioned in my introduction that Nigeria, of course, is about a quarter of Africa's population, still a very fast population growth rate, as I recall, not so fast of a GDP growth rate, partly because Nigeria is dependent on oil exports, and it's one of the many countries, therefore, that's seen its revenues plateau or drop in recent times, as oil's been at an historic low for several years. And so you put together the different pieces of stresses in Northeast Nigeria, other security problems that Vonda referred to, flat or declining oil revenue, rapidly growing population, which has some advantages, but also, of course, some drains and strains on an economy. And you put that all in the context of an impressive young democracy that's trying to make its way through early elections in the sense that, you know, we're only a few cycles of democratically elected presidents in Nigeria's history in which elections have been reasonably well regarded. But that's a pretty good accomplishment. And I think President Buhari is running for re-election, and the elections would be next year. And so anything you want to add to tie the issues we're talking about today to this broader picture of where Nigeria finds itself? One very concrete question is, to the extent that resources are needed for any of the initiatives that you're proposing, it looks to me like it would be relatively difficult to expect the government to come up with a lot of them on its own, given its, you know, stressed budgetary situation. So does that mean the international community needs to help? Mark, you referred to the greater amount of humanitarian aid last year, but is there also an argument for a development boost, a boost in the development budgets to help northeastern Nigeria and other parts of the country, you know, with some of the more enduring challenges and problems? So that's one question on my mind. But anything else you each may want to add to sort of painting this big, broad picture of where Nigeria finds itself today? Any further comments, Vonda?
Well, Mike, one of the constraints that you did not mention and that continues to be dominating Nigeria is, of course, massive corruption. So with all the stress of economic decline, corruption continues to be pervasive. President Buhari, early on in his administration, indicted the former national security advisor for President Goodluck Jonathan for massive theft of anti-Boko Haram resources. Several other indictments have taken place. But unfortunately, perhaps not surprisingly, this has hardly resulted in systematic cleaning of Nigerian institutions. It's still deeply patronage and clientelism-ridden society, and corruption is massive and debilitates and undermines both delivery of services but also legitimacy of the state. And thus the original Yusuf Muhammad narrative and the narrative of justice still resonates very strongly in northeast Nigeria and in other parts of Nigeria as well. And that context is important to understand in the context of civil society, young technocratic society, that's often enormously impressive. There are young, not just young, people in Nigeria who are enormously admirable and enormously inspiring. Yet, again, it was something that we have encountered together in Afghanistan, yet those very enormously impressive people have not been able to change the system. And is it just a matter of time, or do other elements need to click into place? And clearly, one of the elements is that the international community, Nigeria's partners, people who are committed, countries who are committed to Nigeria, such as the United States, demand accountability. Nigeria has failed, the Nigerian society has often failed to demand accountability, and when it has asked for it, it's not been given it. We need to support those who ask for accountability and ask systematic accountability of our partners, of our counterparts, in delivering humanitarian aid, in delivering development aid. Tremendous amount of development aid is going into northeast Nigeria. The budgets are very large. But the constant fear is, how will that aid actually be used? And what levels of oversight? The same when we cooperate with the Nigerian military. We need to demand accountability and draw lines that some levels of egregious human rights violations will simply not be tolerated.
Thank you. Alexandra, any thoughts?
Mine were sort of similar, but obviously more about humanitarian aid. And even so, the week before Secretary Tillerson traveled to Nigeria and ultimately then resigned, when he announced the funds that he allocated...
Was fired.
Anyways, he announced that aid should always, that good governance should be incentivized by aid. And that's something that is crucial with this. This is basic bad governance. And this is not something that is only true in northeastern Nigeria. It is true around Nigeria as a whole. But this is something that we all need to do. And it's not just donor governments. It's also donor institutions and making sure that none of their funds are being used for harmful policies. And the issue of corruption falls into that category. It happens on every single level of a humanitarian response with regards to the government or other organizations as well. And you see a lot of skimming off the top of food distributions. We heard multiple allegations that certain bodies that were being given large sums of Nigerian government money was a present for someone who was about to retire, that they created a new organization and it was just a gift, and then that money went nowhere and no one knows where it's been. And my question is, if Nigeria, you said that Nigeria doesn't have the funds to sort of help itself, and if it has the funds to pay off all these people with corrupt bribes, then it probably has the funds to do a much better job than it's been doing so far.
Good point. Thank you. Mark.
Yeah, I mean, just the in terms of longer-term development efforts and U.S. interest to promote accountability, leveraging the significant investment the U.S. has already made, it didn't help that the Secretary of State was fired while he was on his trip to Africa just after having met with Nigerian leaders. So something needs to change in terms of U.S. orientation towards Africa if we're going to demonstrate that kind of, I think, what is the actual commitment of U.S. policy towards Africa.
Do we only have an acting assistant secretary for Africa now as well?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so let's go to you. Please wait for a microphone, and please identify yourself when you get it, and we'll have three questions or so at a time. I'm going to start in about the seventh row. My friends here, they're two hands up, so we'll begin both of those questions in about the seventh row, and then we'll come up here for one more before coming back to the panel.
Sure. Hi, my name is Saskia Brechtmacher, and I'm an associate fellow in the Democracy Program at the Carnegie Endowment. And my question is mainly for Wanda, but also for the others, perhaps, to chime in. You mentioned that there's a huge need to restore government presence and government services in Northeast Nigeria, because there's a real gap there at the moment. And I was wondering if you could comment on the state of current efforts to return local government in particular in those areas, especially given the fact that local government in many ways is dysfunctional across Nigeria, not just in the Northeast. So what do these efforts look like, and also international support for those efforts?
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Morgan with Vertical Enterprises. I have a quick two-part question. First for Vonda and Alexandra. With the problems in Cameroon along that border, did you see any evidence of spillover, whether Nigerians going across the border to assist in Cameroon or the Cameroonians coming across to fight and assist Boko Haram, because we've had heard reports of Boko Haram fighters actually speaking French. And then, have we seen any other spillover, not just from that and from CAR, not just from fighters, but also weapons and other things? And second, you talked about the government. Who do you think would be actually able to deliver these services better? Would it be the federal government, or would it be the state governments? Because for years, we have not seen a willingness of Abuja, whether it's been the Jonathan government or the current government of President Buhari, to actually engage in these three states. Who should actually do it?
Now let's take one more before we come back to the panel. Okay, so I guess we'll come up here. We'll work from back to front. So we'll go with the woman in the fourth row who helped us out with the microphone issue earlier. Thanks.
My name is Deirdre Le Pin. I've worked for a number of bilateral, multilateral organizations in Nigeria for the last 40 years and lived in the country for an extended period. I was last in the Northeast doing a health project for the ministry 4 years ago, so that was before the last push of Boko Haram. I have a couple of questions. One is, are there a lot of interesting parallels between the Boko Haram insurgency and the militancy in the Niger Delta? And as you know, in 2009, there was an amnesty program that was put in place. And there's been a lot of discussion in Nigeria about repeating that experience in the north. I wondered if you had any views on the idea of amnesty for particularly the civilian JTF and some of the Boko Haram fighters. And with respect to the civilian JTF, it would seem that a very natural opportunity for them would be to create a large government-driven program that could develop the North and do rehabilitation in the North by drawing on the labor force of the civilian JTF. Many of them have shown quite a lot of leadership in their work. So is that a possibility in your view?
So why don't we go to the panel? Feel free to take whichever one or two you might want. Vanda, I think a few were directed to you, so do you want to go first or last?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, we'll start with Mark, and then hopefully you guys will get some of the questions out of the way and then make Vanda's life a little easier here because she had about two or three. So over to you to start, please,
yeah.
Mark.
So thank you for that, Vanda, for taking on the bulk of the questions. I'll just touch on the issue of Cameroon, and it's again, another challenge faced by the Nigerian government is, in addition to Nigerians who have fled into Cameroon, there are now Cameroonians who have fled into Nigeria due to internal conflict in Cameroon. And so it just adds another dimension to the challenges faced by the government in addition to those displaced by Boko Haram. I think that it's more just to put it to, I think that it's very easy to get focused just on what's happening in the Northeast, and it's just another opportunity to kind of broaden the lens in addition to the herder conflict, farmer herder conflict and what's happening in the Niger Delta, to understand the full complexity of what's happening in the country rather than just being focused on one area. So I'll leave it there.
Also, with regards to that, I mean, you mentioned that Boko Haram fighters were speaking French. Boko Haram is predominantly in four countries, three out of which are Francophone. I'm not particularly surprised by that. I think that there is a lot of cross-border, and, I mean, with the rise of the ebbs and flows of sort of like Chad, it's probably pretty common, but I can't speak for the linguistic skills, really. Just to answer the question about the CJTF and prospects for them within, like, a government plan, that is part of Governor Shatima's plan for these returns, is to have this program where they become agro rangers so that they would protect, so within the 5 kilometer radius, sort of the town would be in the middle and around would be, you know, surrounding farms and forest or whatever, which would be protected by the CJTF. What the prospects of that, I mean, how feasible that is, or if it's actually going to happen, or when it would happen, is hard to tell when the conflict is still ongoing and they're still actively participating and hugely relied upon by the Nigerian military. I mean, I can't speak for that, but I'm just saying that this is something that someone's thinking about. I don't know how feasible it is or if it's a good idea.
Thank you.
Well, let me pick up with the CJTF question. I have real concerns about this plan, and I have significant concerns also about simply rolling CJTF in significant portions into any kind of position where they can control access. So many people in Northeast Nigeria see CJTF as heroes. Often there was no state presence, no military, no police, and CJTF was defending them against the military. However, CJTF has come to be a major source of human rights abuses. As I mentioned, its denunciation of who is Boko Haram and who is not are highly arbitrary. There is often motivation of economic advantage to seize property, old revenge at place, or simply to get payoffs from the military for particular denunciation. CJTF has come to start challenging local government authorities as well as traditional village elders. There is real power contestation between those set of actors. There is no clear commander to CJTF. Nominally, CJTF is under the Borno State Attorney General. In practice, control is highly questionable. And as I mentioned, there are real efforts to politicize CJTF. In my view, there needs to be a program that acknowledges their service to the countries, that deals with crucial issues such as widows of CJTF that might be extremely vulnerable, but that at the end of the day leads to systematic demobilization and reintegration. To the extent that CJTF is given any official positions in police, rehabilitation, paramilitary control, the same standard of accountability that needs to be applied to Nigerian institutions need to be applied to them. They are also guilty of severe human rights violations. They often are exclusionary. We hear all about Boko Haram and cattle rustling. Well, guess what? There's a lot of involvement in CJTF in cattle rustling. Many CJTF members used to be drug addicts and drug dealers. They maintain their linkages. So, you know, to the extent that we say CJTF takes on official authorities, then there needs to be real screening and weeding out of bad elements. Thank you for the question on MENT. I think it's a very fundamental question for Nigeria. This is the 2009 deal with the Delta insurgents. I think it has broader repercussions significance beyond Nigeria. What I think was very good about the MENT deal is that the Nigerian state, the Nigerian military, for the first time really were willing to contemplate and adopt a non-military solution. At the end, there was a negotiated deal. It was a huge breakthrough in the context of Nigeria history. That said, I think that the deal was badly designed and is haunting us now. It was badly designed because it essentially involved blanket amnesty for anyone associated with the insurgency and multiple sets of insurgency, not just MENT, and financial payoffs. So in Nigeria, the MENT deal is often referred to as buying peace, and a peace that is in troubles now that the Buhari government has suspended payments. we have seen uptick of violence, not necessarily from key men, leaders who have become prominent politicians, who have also become millionaires and billionaires as a result of the deal. So there was, in my view, extremely problematic message that Nigeria repeatedly resorts to. You buy your way out of troubles by paying off your opponents. In the same way that one can suggest that it's problematic to pay Boko Haram for releasing its hostages. And worse, though, the underlying conditions, the issues of victims, the issues of socioeconomic degradation, all the underlying grievances in the region were not at all addressed. So while considering amnesty, leniency, negotiation issues is crucial, needs to be on the table, in many ways, the Mendeel is a lesson in what not to replicate, not what to do again, in my view. And this just ties a little bit to the local government authorities. You know, you were very right to phrase the question in restore. I would say the issue is not even restored at this point, because restore what? Systems that have often been problematic or collapsed. So the question is, how does one build accountability? How does one build government interlocutors at the local level that come to represent people? And there are very interesting and very encouraging Nigerian NGO efforts to teach local communities how to identify problems, how to engage in early warning, how to set up leadership structures and communicate with other faces, with other aspects of government, state government, federal government. That I would love to see the Nigerian state and international community to support. So I would not really phrase it, bring back the LGAs or even restore them, but rather think about how new structures of accountability can be built at local level. And the issue of the state, federal, local lack of coordination, tensions, counter working against each other, continues to be massive and present in the Northeast and well beyond.
Thank you. Let's do another round of questions. I think this time we'll start over here in the fourth row, please. And we'll work around the room a little bit.
Good day. My name is Maiwa Kemade. I'm a Nigerian-American student at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. Basically, my question today is about the upcoming elections in 2019. And how they're going to impact the investment or the amount of attention being paid into the Boko Haram crisis. Like you mentioned, the situation is not the same as it was a few years ago. And I feel that was because there was an election in 2015. And one of the main talking points during that election was Boko Haram, Chibok girls, what's happening. However, since the Buhari administration has come into power, there's been a stall in the amount of investment, the amount of work the military has done. So my question basically is, with the upcoming election, we've also seen the return of Dapuchi girls. My question basically is, with the upcoming election in 2019, over a year away, how do you think this will impact the more investment being paid into the crisis? And would you see a ramp up in efforts to be able to technically or actually defeat Boko Haram? And what, how will it impact the different areas that Boko Haram has affected? Thank you.
Great, thanks. And then, see, we'll go to the woman in the blue shirt, about six rows back, please. And then we'll take the question from the gentleman in that same row, and then come back.
Hi, my name is Beth Lamprin. I work at the Department of State in the Nigeria unit. So it's an issue near and dear to my heart. Just to answer your question, yes, there are members of Boko Haram. They do have camps in northern Cameroon. We've seen videos of them speaking French, talking directly to President Biya and making threats on him. In terms of a negotiated settlement, I know that the government has been putting that out in the media recently. Has anybody thought about what it would take for either of these groups to lay down their arms and return to a normal state? It's something that people have been talking about, but since the government's now speaking about it, what are the chances and what would the conditions be in your estimation?
Thank you. And one more.
Thank you. My name is Josh Nathan. I work with Bridge International Academies. We're a social enterprise that operates low-fee private schools and free government schools in five countries around the world, including in Nigeria. We're actually very proud to be working in one school in Borno State in collaboration with the Nigerian Stock Exchange. My question is about education and about some of what any of you have seen in terms of the really scaled rebuilding of the right sorts of services to encourage people who are IDPs to return to their communities, and also to create the right framework for those returnees to be able to live successfully and to gain things like an education in their communities. Thank you.
Okay, so shall we start with Alexandra this time?
Sure.
And then go to Vonda and Mark?
I'll start with the last question, just with regards to education. In Borno, Governor Shettima keeps announcing that he is in the process of building mega schools all around the state, where he hopes to have people return to their areas. He says that they're being built in Maiduguri. I don't know exactly how fast that's going to happen and if that's going to happen to the extent that he is announcing it. I know that the huge issue with education is the lack of identification cards. So people cannot access government services, including health centers, getting birth registration, or attend school if they don't have government ID cards, which is something that even before the conflict no one had, or if they did have it, they lost them in fleeing. So that's been a huge issue. However, it is a project that UNHCR is working on. So that's something that we do call for increased funding on for them. So that's all I can say with regards to education. Say that,
it's lacking.
So it's 23 mega schools that the government has announced. I visited some of them, and the physical construction of some of them is fairly close. But the issue is sort of the typical one: what does delivering education mean? Is it a building, even a building that looks better than other buildings, or is it the quality of education that's provided? Who will have access and how? Governor Shettima justifies the building of the schools also by pointing to the fact that there are 60,000 orphans as a result of the conflict, children whose parents, or at least one parent, perished either as a result of Boko Haram activities or counterinsurgency. The issue of course, education, however, intimately links not just to those but to detention camps. We have many children in detention camps, and children from very young age up to 18. The schooling they're getting there is one of radicalization and resentment. There is, of course, the issue of Al-Majiri. Those are the boys for whom parents cannot really adequately provide, so they send them to mullahs for Islamic education that may entail some sort of memorization of Quran, but that often serve as an economic labor force for the mullahs. They are sent to beg in the streets, and that's how they spend most of the day. Clearly, there needs to be some thinking, some regularization of the extent to which boys can be used for that purpose. I would say they shouldn't be used for that purpose. So how does one then deliver some economic resources to madrasas and mullahs, under what circumstances? So very many issues of education that need to be resolved in a northeast, which other than northwest tends to have the worst human development indices. So, for example, when we hear about the issue of the Chibok girls who were sitting for their high school exam, well, in reality, many a person who is just about to complete high school in Nigeria will probably not be literate or numerate. So, again, what does literacy mean? Thank you for the question about the negotiated settlement. This is not the first time that the current government and the previous government have spoken about negotiated settlements. There have been multiple offers to Boko Haram. Multiple times the government has announced that it has made the deal only for Boko Haram to respond with massacres as well as rejection. Certainly the Shekau faction, if Shekau is still alive, big dispute in Nigeria, who is Shekau? But anyway, their faction seemed to have been opposed to a negotiated deal. A crucial problem is precisely what you identify, the tendency of the Nigerian government to shroud everything in utter secrecy, so no one knows what the dimensions actually are, that also makes for very difficult negotiations. Currently, there is a defectors program called Operation Safe Corridor, in which people who either join Boko Haram or often just had to live under Boko Haram rule can hand themselves over to the Nigerian military, and they should be eligible for leniency and support in terms of DDR. In practice, those who run away, for example, a man who lived for 5 years under Boko Haram rule and finally has a chance to escape, will really have no way of knowing whether he will be killed by the military, at what point, whether he'll be killed by the JTF. Will he, in fact, end up in the Operation Safety Gombe corridor? And if so, whether he will be judged low risk or high risk. If he is judged high risk, then he will end up in detention for a prolonged period of time, perhaps die in detention in really bad conditions, be lost in the system, maybe head to trials. The one big development over the past few months is that finally some trials for Boko Haram members are starting to take place. It's crucial to get the 20,000 people out of the detention camps. We know very little about the trials, absolute secrecy. We hear that some people are sentenced. We also hear that masses of people in the detention camps cannot be sent to trial because there is no evidence, and they would have to be let loose, yet the government is loath, the military is loath to let them loose. So you have people who cannot be tried, who were tortured, on whom there is no evidence, but who cannot be released. So all of this just feeds into the notion of any negotiated settlement will have to resolve multiple points of policy even before you get to the talking point, and multiple points of clarification of what you're actually going to offer Boko Haram. And the second huge dimension of it is that I want to come back to what I was saying before. Any negotiated deal will need to grapple with the huge resentment, polarization of society, with the sense of rejection of anyone who lived under Boko Haram rule. And if simply the government makes a deal a la the Mandelta based on financial payoffs and letting people just come back into communities, the odds are new forms of conflict will rapidly escalate, and there will be huge resentment that the victims, the right victims, didn't get compensation. And the 2019 elections, in my view, complicate everything. They push for policies that are short-term policies to demonstrate big, dramatic unveiling with often very flimsy problems. And they push for politicization of processes that need to be not about politicization, but about accountability and sustainability.
Mark. Just a couple of quick things to add on the issue around elections and the promotion of certain narrative compared to what the reality is. It's just been concerning the increasing challenges we've seen, at least anecdotally, in terms of the Nigerian press being able to access areas of northeast Nigeria that are at the epicenter of the crisis, so that that reality can be conveyed to people throughout the rest of the country. So as much as we can promote press freedom and press access, I think it's quite significant. And then something we encountered when it relates to not necessarily negotiated settlement, but future of Boko Haram fighters who go through demobilization. Nigerians we met with and through our engagement with the local community, there was certainly a strong interest in disarmament and demobilization to go forward, but a real kind of unwillingness to necessarily accept Boko Haram fighters back into their communities. And so I'd be interested, I mean, from your side, from lessons learned from, because it's been out of my lane, from past DDR programs, or demobilization programs, how to address that issue when the communities from which the fighters came are unwilling to accept them even after they're demobilized.
And also the issue of providing them with services and sort of like rehabilitation and training, and then returning to a community where no one there has been offered that same sort of luxury to a certain extent, where people haven't been able to access, you know, livelihoods, and that is not going to be good for long-term social cohesion. So coming up with plans that do take that into account.
You know, it's just the issue of parity, of giving rehabilitation services, socioeconomic services to communities, mm-hmm. not just to former militants, should have been, is nominally part of DDR processes mm-hmm. for a long time. But the Nigeria case really just drives it home to me in a way that you don't see in Somalia, you don't see in Afghanistan, where the level of polarization, the level of rejection is so intense that clearly the programming such as psychosocial therapy needs to go not just to people in IDP camps, not just to for people accused of having association with Boko Haram, but to communities themselves. Any kind of provision of socioeconomic services will need to, if not be matched, but will need to be comparable in providing socioeconomic services to communities. Engages bulamas, nawans, the community leaders, religious leaders, as vectors of communication, using these kind of broader societal reconciliation processes, also to empower women. There is one program, for example, that is inspiring, that's run in Maiduguri, where widows, where women who are associated with Boko Haram affiliation, who, for example, had Boko Haram husbands, participate in a joint vocational training, joint cooperatives with widows of CJTF. And that's very, in my view, very effective way in thinking about how that can be scaled up and replicate to try to bring two sets of extremely vulnerable people, often greatly resenting each other, together to be both empowered but also to start healing the divisions in the community. But that aspect is really strong and major obstacle in Nigeria, very unique.
We have time for one last round of questions, so let's do that and then we'll wrap up here. Okay, yeah, so that, in fact, I see three hands, so we'll take one, two, three, and then we'll wrap.
Hi, thank you for this informative panel. My name is Contessa Bourbon, and I write for the Wall Street Journal and London Times. I'd like to ask the panelists, should foreign governments like U.S., Canada, France, and others directly support the negotiated settlement with government and Boko Haram or exert their leverage, or should they support more military actions and intelligence and to combat Boko Haram militarily? What is your recommendation?
Thank you. And over here, please.
Good afternoon. Nate Allen at Johns Hopkins University. So I think as many of us know, corruption is endemic to Nigeria's governing institutions, its military. I mean, Vonda, you mentioned how some members of the CJTF are kind of involved in cattle rustling. We also know that kind of some major arms contracts have gone missing, and there's also some circumstantial evidence, for example, that members of the military have sold arms to, like, Boko Haram insurgents. So kind of my question is, given that there's some evidence that kind of they're both sides, both on the government side and on the insurgent side, benefit from the conflict economy, how do you see that affecting kind of the long-term prospects for peace? So, like, first of all, given that there's this benefit on both sides, is a negotiated settlement, which is what the consensus seems to be, is the likely solution even possible? And if it is, kind of what steps do you think that officials need to take to kind of limit the possibilities for continued kind of corruption on both sides to kind of act as a spoiler to resolving the conflict over the long term?
And the last question, please.
Jack McCaslin with the Council on Foreign Relations. So you briefly mentioned NGOs as providing some, making the situation a little bit better. Who else can people on the ground actually trust, whether it's religious leaders, community leaders, or some sort of economic leaders, and what role can those leaders play in providing opportunity, security, and community healing?
Mark, you want to start this round, and we'll just finish up with Vonda after Alexandra? Whichever ones you like, and concluding.
Yeah. And I do think that Vaughn is also going to be taking the bulk of this, but I think the last question is quite important. I think fortunately, Nigeria does have a very robust civil society, and there are a number of local aid organizations and civil society-based organizations that were around long before the broader humanitarian architecture descended in Northeast Nigeria. And so it's essential for support to those groups to continue and for the international partners on the ground to be partnering, I think, more directly with those local organizations. Because it, in addition to the sort of challenges on the government side, I think that one of the good things we saw is significant engagement by local Nigerians themselves to try to help relieve some of the stresses and challenges. So afterwards, happy to give you the names of specific groups, but it's something that I think needs to be acknowledged as a positive side of this.
Great. Alexandra, to you, please.
I don't think I can answer the other two questions. I think that it would be really inappropriate for me to say if the government, if foreign governments should negotiate with Boko Haram or provide funds for them to negotiate or provide more military. I think that's just not within, I can tell you my really unsolicited opinion about it, but it's not within my professional realm. And with regards to corruption and the benefit from the conflict economy, I think it's obviously extremely prevalent. Everyone is profiting from this response, whether it be militarily or the military response or the humanitarian response or anything. It's definitely something that is happening. And with regards to a negotiated settlement, what that means is depends what that negotiated settlement would be and what that would mean, because I think that looking at, I mean, I spoke to someone this weekend who said something and just said that it's really dangerous when you're starting to pay your terrorists more than you pay your military, and that's a really alarming trend, and there's a huge benefit right now for Boko Haram with everything that's going on in the current approach.
Thank you. Vanda.
You know, the issue of the war economy, unfortunately, in Nigeria also intersects with the issue of the peace economy. This goes back to the MENT deal, right? So nominally, the MENT 2009 Delta deal had a robust package for the reconstruction of the River State Delta, the South. In retrospect, vast amount of that money was usurped for personal pockets and political patronage networks. In many ways, any kind of injection of money, whether it's stimulated by conflict or stimulated by peace, can easily be siphoned off and misappropriated. And that is, you know, it is this issue of corruption, unaccountable, neglectful state, and politics where the state is like mafia bazaar, with the purpose of politics being to issue exceptions from law enforcement to one's clique, that unless that is resolved, we will see peace negotiations producing usurpation of money and being buy-offs, and we'll see war economies being personal enrichment rackets. I do want to emphasize, though, that from the perspective of many of the local soldiers and units, we need to have a great deal of sympathy and understanding for them. The level of theft starts from higher-level officers. So by the time a unit is deployed somewhere to Yobe, they might not have bullets, they might not have functioning weapons, they might have extremely meager rations. What wonder is there that they will try to text whatever moves on the roads between them, such as between Cameroon, you know, from diapers to spaghetti. It's one of the big rackets, actually, that's going on, just taxing legal goods and controlling, very significantly controlling who has access to legal goods. And, you know, again, President Buhari needs to be commended in his early days in the presidency, focusing on that. Now the question is how those individual indictments will really result in prosecutions and will take on systemic level effects, and we haven't seen that. Corruption, anti-corruption efforts in Nigeria all too often stay simply measures of retaliation against rival politicians or previous administrations, and I have some concerns about that. And as to the role of the U.S., the United States, of course, considers Nigeria appropriately a partner government. We have extensive and robust engagement with them, and it is up to the Nigerian government to decide how it will handle its conflict. In my view, it's always important to encourage peace negotiations, often understanding, however, that the rivals may not be interested in negotiations. Boko Haram, the only negotiations with Boko Haram that have been effective so far are negotiations about payments, payments for the release of hostages, payments for other actions. Nonetheless, in our support of the Nigerian state, whether it's support for peace negotiations or whether it's support for the Nigerian military, we need to emphasize accountability. We can never tolerate egregious human rights violations, and we should strongly warn and discourage against peace that's bought through corrupt money and that does not resolve the basic underlying problems of poor governance. So if our overarching policy is driven by strong emphasis on good governance, on improving governance in Nigeria, and if that lens is applied both to the military dimensions, which is necessary and crucial, as well as to the peace dimension, then I think our policy will be on the right track.
Well, in conclusion, and before I ask you to join me in thanking the panel, let me just thank you for giving attention to such an important country. I think you know that if we look around the world, there are really only four countries that are more populous than Nigeria, China, India, the United States, and Indonesia. And then you've got Brazil, Pakistan, and Nigeria sort of at that 200 million apiece level, hugely consequential for the future of the planet, certainly for the future of Africa. We also know that, unless I'm doing my math wrong up here, that Nigeria may be the largest country on earth in population where there are very substantial Christian and Muslim populations in the same country, which means it's obviously very important in terms of building bridges and collaborating and finding reliable ways to defeat extremist ideology like Boko Haram's and others. And so for all these reasons, I'm just thrilled to have been part of this discussion, to have learned so much. And again, please join me in thanking the panelists.